Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Welcome to The Source. I am Matt Kinnear, joined by Terry Foy. This is our third week doing this new podcast here on Inside Lacrosse and tackling the biggest subjects in the game. And we've got a big one here with World Lacrosse approving the Lacrosse Sixes discipline, the six-on-six version of the game that will potentially be seen in the Olympic Games. So, Terry, this is something that, you have been following this for such a long time. It's been kind of a passion project. It's been an interest of yours, the Olympic inclusion and all of that goes with it. Tell me a little bit about, the nuts and bolts of what we just saw here, and also just your background of, why is this such an important issue to you and what have you done following it?
Sure. Well, yeah, so thanks for laying that out. I think it's important to start by saying that what happened last weekend was the World Lacrosse General Assembly, which is comprised of the 68 member nations, met virtually for their annual meeting, and or at the very least a quarterly meeting upon which this was on the on the docket, and approved the advancement of a rule set for this 6v6 discipline that has really been in development for 2 years or a little bit more. And I don't want to call it a rubber stamp, but it was certainly expected, I think, that this would be a step that was taken. And it was really important that it was taken now because, and I think World Lacrosse has done a nice job of emphasizing this point coming away from it. When we saw a rule set for this discipline last time, particularly leading up to the Fall Classic at US Lacrosse in October of 2019, it was pretty limited in terms of the amount of detail that went into the rule book. And on the 17th, November 17th, 2020, the World Lacrosse issued a more expanded rule book that goes into much greater detail as toward what's allowable and what's permissible in this discipline of the game. And so clearly there's been a lot of work done in order to approach what is a final rule book. The reason that it's important to do this now is because of the available time between now and the 2022 World Games in Birmingham, Alabama, around which there was so much attention paid with respect to the Iroquois Nationals inclusion. And ultimately that ended up in a, I think, 99.9% of the population's eyes, a very positive resolution, as the Iroquois Nationals have been invited and accepted the invitation to play in Birmingham. The game is going to be 6v6 in Birmingham. So in order to be prepared for that, a firm rule set and the ability to play under that rule set over the course of 2021 and early 2022 is essential in order for it not to look terrible when the men's and women's teams take the field for the first time on a global multi-sport stage, but first time that men's lacrosse will be played in that format in this kind of era of development. So that's kind of why this past weekend's approval was important. But like I said, World Lacrosse has I think, done a good job of making it known that this is still a work in progress. And I think that means both in terms of the rule set that was released this week is going to be continually updated, but also just some of the most fundamental aspects of this are still available for discussion, particularly because while there has been some demonstration of this game, by and large, it still really hasn't been seen played at the highest level and with competitive stakes. And it's impossible to evaluate any game without those conditions having been met. So I think, that's just kind of a big caveat for the entirety of the rest of this conversation. But to the question about why this has been such a point of passion for me, I think it's because it's a reflection of all the work that's been done by World Lacrosse stakeholders. I would say really pointing to the last 13 years in order to get to this point when it really is kind of feasible to imagine lacrosse being included not just in the World Games, but potentially in the Olympics. And a quick summary of the things that have been done are the unification of the men's and women's international governing bodies, the acceptance into Sport Accord, which is another Global Multisport Association, the adherence to World Anti-Doping Agency standards, which was really important. And then I would say that, you know, those events occurred in kind of the 2007 to 2013-14 range. And then in the last 3 or so years, really tipped off by the hiring of Jim Scher as the full-time CEO of World Lacrosse and all of the knowledge and experience that he brings to that role, it's really been kind of a steady march of new initiatives, things that were important in terms of raising not necessarily the sport of lacrosse individually, but the sport of lacrosse and its international governing body and its national member nations, raising their standing in terms of the global stage in an effort to be more credible and more viable for inclusion in multi-sport events going forward. And we'll get into the judgments and whether or not that's a worthwhile initiative and goal. But the simple fact is that it's a worthwhile goal to some stakeholders who have been willing to finance and put their time and energy behind this initiative. And so I think it's important, and this is why I've taken on that role that you mentioned, is because I feel like there's been a relative gap in understanding among the general lacrosse fan as to what's going on, how quickly it's advancing, and how potentially impactful it's going to be for the sport, maybe not so much in the United States, but across the world, and kind of the long tail effect that that might have for lacrosse fans and lacrosse players.
Terry, you and I both love lacrosse. If you listen to this, you know that we love lacrosse. And increasingly, I think we've both found a love and enjoyment for the National Lacrosse League and indoor lacrosse or box lacrosse. Now I think we get to show it a little more because now National Lacrosse League has fan gear from Fanatics for the first time. You know, something if we want to drive up to Philly and go catch a Wings game or take the train up to Long Island, you know, we can rock our gear now. Fanatics is now the official shop for the National Lacrosse League. Get fan gear wherever you live, whoever you root for. You can show your NLL pride, hoodies, shirts, half zips, sweatshirts, long sleeves, hats, and of course, everyone's favorite jerseys. So this is really cool because, you know, Terry, you know, I'm a big NHL fan. Right now, I'm actually wearing a Capitals hoodie, Capitals hat, all stuff that I got on the NHL's Fanatics shop. So now there's a way, and I've always thought, you know, how come it's not as easy to wear NLL gear? It's not as easy to show off your lacrosse gear. Now you can because NLLshop.com, it's the Fanatics NLL gear store. We can definitely get some merch. We can get some San Diego Seals hoodies for us, whatever we want. So if you're getting ready for the 2021 National Lacrosse League season, Fanatics is going to ship it right to your door. So this is awesome development for the sport. Fanatics, it's the only place to buy official NLL fan gear. Get yours in time for the upcoming season and get yours in time for, you know, the holidays. You're going to be seeing your family and your friends. Show them what lacrosse is. Be an ambassador for the sport. Save 25% when you use promo code IL20. So that's shopnll.com/IL20. Shopnll.com/IL20. That's a promo code to get 25% off. This is a huge development for the sport, so please take advantage of that. Terry, back to the podcast.
That might be the shortest promo code I've ever heard. IL20, it's just 4 characters. If you don't put that in, shame on you. But Matt, it's not just about getting ready for the 2021 NLL season. It's also about getting ready for the 2022 NLL season. Because one of the other pieces of big news from this week was the Panther City. How about that? Panther City LC. What'd you think of that?
You know, I loved the branding. I love those branding descriptions where they talk about like what goes into picking a name. Yeah. I was a little hesitant because I'm not like the LC format doesn't quite appeal to me. But after reading the Panther City and the history of that nickname, it seems
very like cool.
That community will get it. And that's what's important. So I'm pretty pumped about it. And you know, one thing I noticed, lots of purple in the NLL. Lots of purple uniforms.
I was going to say the exact same thing. I mean, there is some you mentioned the Seals, and I thought that their branding announcement was really cool in the way that they drew on the local nature of the Navy Seals in San Diego, but also the ability to create a mascot that appealed to kids. And I think from that standpoint, Panther City kind of accomplishes something similar. It has a local hook, but you know, Panther's just a great logo. And we did our fall feature on High Point the same day that they announced the logo. And I was just like, it's not a coincidence that it's Panther Day on the NLL. So make sure you, or I'm sorry, on InsideLacrosse.com. So make sure you head to NLLShop.com once the Panther City gear drops in order to round out your kind of like full suite of NLL team apparel.
Yeah, they got, if you go to it right now, there's a big promo for the new Panther City gear. So lots to like on that NLLShop.com. Terry, I have a one-word question that I'll expand on, and that's why. So I think the short answer for, you know, this 6-on-6 discipline is inclusion in the Olympics. But obviously it's a lot more detailed than that, and there's more to it. So I'll ask the question again, why?
So the order in which I answer the question is reflective of the order in which individuals care about it. And I think that there's a distinction between, do we care about the sport of lacrosse growing internationally independent from the prospect of Olympic inclusion? And if you are a true believer in the creator's game, the answer should be yes. And one of the adjacent questions to the idea of why is, what is lacrosse? What are the non-negotiables that make lacrosse what it is? And I think when you hearken all the way back to the game's roots, it really just is a stick, a ball, and a goal. The number of players on the field, the size of the field, the shape of the stick, the material of the ball, the size of the goal, the shape of the goal, all these things have changed so substantially, not just over the last 500 years, but I mean, even if you look at the sport right now, according to the NCAA, the number of players on the field and the size of the field is different between men's and women's lacrosse. So clearly, those are elements of the game that are not essential in order to have a quote-unquote bona fide lacrosse, a true version of the game. So the answer to the question why is either because this version of the game slots more easily into the parameters of hosting the Olympics, or because this version of the game is easier to access all across the country, all across the world. We take for granted that you can, in the United States, pretty easily put together a group of 20 players, take on another group of 20 players. And, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of kids and hundreds of, you know, thousands of adults all over the country that do this every week. But if you're in a certain part of the world where you haven't seen the game, or you don't know how to buy a lacrosse stick, or whatever the case may be, the ability to field teams of 12 to play each other in women's field lacrosse, or the ability to field teams of 10 to play each other in men's lacrosse, can be the difference between actually playing a game versus not. Whereas the ability to field teams of 6 clearly is going to be somewhere between 180% easier. And so I think that is the starting point. But like I said, it's also easier to slot into the overall Olympic program. In addition to all of the evolution that lacrosse has undergone over the course of the last, like what I just laid out, you know, decade with a heavy emphasis on the last 3 years, the Olympic movement has undergone an incredible amount of evolution in a very short recent period of time. And it's not just about rescheduling the Tokyo Summer Games from 2020 to 2021, but that is certainly a big part of it. It's also about the increased desire and need among Olympic stakeholders to both appeal to a younger audience and reduce the burden of hosting the games on the cities that have hosted it, or the cities that will host it in the future. And certainly there's a distinction there between the Summer and Winter Olympics, and a lot of that is important and germane to this conversation, but not the type of thing I expect our audience to be interested in right now, so we're not going to get into that. But the core issue that the hosts have to solve for every time the Olympics come to town is the number of athletes. That is the thing that has the potential to really spiral out of control and make the games much more costly than they would otherwise be. So when the Olympics kind of reimagined the bid process, starting from a point of we are going to put a cap on the number of athletes, was a key factor. So if you can bring a game to the Olympics that requires fewer players, and in this scenario, the rosters are limited to 12, and I don't think we know whether the idea is for there to be 6 or 8 teams at a prospective Olympic Games, and then obviously doubled to have men's and women's. But you're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of, if there's 6 teams, that's 72 athletes. If there's 8 teams, that's 96. You double it, it's somewhere between 140 to 200 athletes. That's a big number, for sure. But the other side of the coin is the hosts have now, and they have done so for Tokyo and done so for France. They have yet to do so for Los Angeles, but it's expected, particularly if this local host program goes well in Tokyo, that they would extend it for the 28 games. But essentially, they've given hosts the opportunity to add sports that are geographically relevant to their locale in an effort to increase interest in prospective new sport. And there's broadcast components to that, there's on-site attendance components to that, and then there's games legacy components to it. Did you contribute something to the local community that promoted the development of that sport in your part of the country? So when you look at the games that were added exclusively for the Tokyo Olympics, there's martial arts, there's climbing, and I think those two represent a combination of local interest as well as budding overall global interest, right? Like climbing has just become much more popular in the last 10 to 20 years, and that's why a climbing discipline is, it makes sense in the Olympics. And, you know, martial arts certainly has its historic roots in East Asia and in Japan, and so that makes sense from a local hosting standpoint. And so when you overlay that with LA and their interest in potentially hosting the game, or in potentially adding lacrosse to the games that they're hosting in 2028, you know, it certainly calls into and calls to mind the idea of lacrosse's popularity in the United States and its growth on the West Coast and all that sort of stuff. So that's kind of the why from an Olympic standpoint, but from a scalability internationally standpoint, not only is the game easier to play, but it's also easier to get good at quickly. And competitive balance is one of the factors that will be considered when it comes to, should this sport be included in multi-sport disciplines going forward, or is it just another opportunity to give a gold medal to the U.S.? Or, in this case, we'll talk about this, Canada. And there is strong disdain against that among the IOC with its kind of European bent. And so a game that features 5 players on the field, and we've seen this with the way in which basketball has gotten more competitive over the last 30 years globally in terms of the number of teams that can compete for medals and you know, everything that goes along with that. Depth is not as important, and the ability to have one transcendent star have a disproportionate outcome on the game is higher, right? And so if your country can produce that star, then the likelihood that you're going to be able to be competitive is higher. And it's the same. You can make a similar argument. Obviously, this is going to be different. I understand that field and box lacrosse are different, but look no further than the fact that the Iroquois Nationals have basically now secured the right of first refusal on the bronze medal, but haven't seriously competed for a gold and silver in field lacrosse, whereas in box lacrosse, they essentially have a stranglehold on the silver medal, and the U.S. struggles to compete for the silver, right? We've got, you know, kind of a good grip on the bronze. And while that, like I said, is significantly a reflection of the distinction between the community's kind of focus on box versus field, it's also a reflection on the fact that the Iroquois Nationals have a smaller pool of players to draw from, and from that smaller pool of players, they have disproportionately produced stars like Cody Jamison and Lyle Thompson. And as a result, when those guys are on the floor competing against 5 Americans, their impact on the game is higher, and then the impact on the game of the, you know, 15th through 18th player on the bench, and then certainly the 200th to 300th player in the international program is different, right? And so those are some of the reasons that scalability is important.
Terry, back in the fall, there was the event at the U.S. It was about a year ago now, at the U.S. lacrosse facility that featured a lot of these rules. They weren't exactly the same, but there were a lot of these rules. It was USA versus Canada, men and women. What did it look like? And we'll go into more specifics, but just your very general, like in terms of pace of the game, how it felt. What did this rule set look like?
Jamie Monroe called it a West Jenny drill, and I think that that is an apt description in some respects. It was a game where a disproportionate percentage of the time the ball was spent in transition from one end of the field to the other. And I think that it's hard to draw conclusions that are too firm over the course of, you know, whatever period of time going forward, because for every single player, it was basically the first time they had participated in this setting. And standing on the bench side and listening to the players' comments when they were coming off of the field, you know, they were tired. For the women's game, they were particularly concerned about the issue of shooting space and just kind of the lack of a legal defense. And I know that was a huge point of emphasis coming away from that experience in terms of, you know, the ability to shoot from distance as opposed to having to finish on the crease. But really, I think that the main distinction is, you know, it was a game that was really about getting from one end of the field to the other.
Now, Terry, we have a lot of people had a lot of questions for us about, you know, the nitty gritty details of this. So I'm going to kind of run through. But I think a lot of the questions focus on, you know, the kind of co-ed nature of this. You know, obviously there's men's and women's, but the rule set is more uniform across men's and women's than any rule set we've seen before in the sport. So how does that work? You know, is this co-ed? Is it men's and women's? What rules are kind of, you know, maybe conjoined that weren't before?
So certainly one of the goals, and I think that this should be a goal for the sport in general, but certainly for the sport's appearance in the international community, unifying the rule sets is an initiative. There's a core distinction between men's lacrosse and women's lacrosse, and that is the pocket and the stick. That, to my knowledge, is not on the table. It will not change as a part of this. And so as a result, there's always going to be a pretty considerable distinction between these two games. I think that if you were to remove that distinction and either women played with men's sticks, which I think would necessitate more equipment being worn by women because of the threat of the ball when you can shoot it harder with a pocket and really get more whip and a longer cradle into releasing the shot, or if men play with women's sticks, which is an exercise I really, really want to see happen, or if there's some kind of middle ground stick created where, say, the ball or the pocket has half a ball's depth, then you would see even further unification. So as a result, I don't see there being, certainly in some parts of the country and some parts of the world, I can imagine a scenario in which the game is played in a co-ed format, but that is not what is being proposed or laid out in this rule set. If you look at the rule book that was published, it is very clear there is a women's section and a men's section. And that's all you need to know in terms of how distinct the two genders' rule sets are. But then separately, the desire to bring the games closer together, certainly the fact that they are played on the same field, they have the same roster size, same number of players that are on the field, is really important. And then the key distinction besides the stick and presumably the equipment that will be associated, to my knowledge, there's no significant equipment distinction on the men's side. In the version of the game that I saw played last year, men were outfitted exactly the same way as they were in traditional field lacrosse rule sets. The distinction, obviously, is the allowable contact in the men's game. And I think that this rule set is trending toward removing intentional body collisions, which I think our audience would best understand as big hits, but not other types of body contact that you would see in basketball or soccer. So I don't know that to be definitively true. And part of the reason I don't know it to be definitively true harkens back to the earlier comment that I still think this is an evolving process. But to my understanding, shoulder-to-chest collisions are not a part of this game, but hip-to-hip collisions, so to speak, are.
Terry, when you talk about roster construction, you know, I think one of the biggest things that we do every few years is kind of this, you know, who should be on the Team USA roster. When you're looking now, specialists seem to be, are they a thing of the past? You know, how do you select a roster? What do you see in terms of positions? Those kind of questions there, how does it change kind of the construct of what a roster is?
Yeah, so want to shout out James Mcelli for asking the question about whether or not it'll be co-ed and will men wear equipment. And these questions that you're talking about come from John Erickson on Twitter. I solicited questions prior to recording this, so thanks to John for throwing this out. And this is a good opportunity for me to say, first and foremost, I am in favor of a small-sided discipline, a game that is better suited for global scale, that is better suited for Olympic inclusion. I am very much on the record as being an advocate for 7-on-7. And the biggest reason is because to me, when you ask the question, what is essential to lacrosse? A sub-question is, what's essential to field lacrosse? What distinguishes it from box lacrosse? And I think one of the answers is position specificity. And it doesn't necessarily mean specialists. It means the distinction between attackmen, midfielders, and defensemen. And I would like to see a version of the game in the Olympics where the best defensemen and the best attackmen have a role. And while I don't know how the strategy is going to evolve, I don't think the best defensemen in the game have a place in 5-on-5. Because I don't think that the substitution patterns are going to allow too much for, or really call for, lockdown defensive specialists. So going back to the experience of watching last year's game, where the U.S. played Canada, particularly the men's game, but this was true for both, they played one half in which it was 5-on-5 full field, meaning that there was no runner held back. It was just the goalie, meaning the goalie couldn't cross half field. That was offsides. So, you know, it's offense 5 versus defense 6 on both ends of the field. In the second half of each game, they played with runner held back. So it was essentially 4 offensive players versus 5 on one end of the field, and then, you know, obviously the same on the other end. So basically, it allowed for one offense and one defensive specialist. A couple of things that were noteworthy out of that. Number one, there was more transition in the second half because those headman passes were available, right? Like, there's a big difference between a one-on-one with the goalie versus a essentially two-on-one with one defender and a goalie, and the ability to get the goalie to move and the offensive player. And sorry, you know, the ball carrier can draw the slide, move it to the other wide open attacker, and then the goalie is moving. It's just a much easier finish. And the second was that fatigue didn't seem to be as big of an issue because subbing through that player being held back was a more meaningful strategy. In this version of the game, where 5 runners are allowed on both ends of the field, you know, is it kind of a full 5-person substitution? Is it, you know, cycle one player through every time up and down the field and you're expected to take 4 runs? Those are questions that are still going to be answered. I do think that some of the best offensive players who are strictly attackmen are going to have value in this game, but there is such a heavy emphasis on ball movement compared to dodging. And that's why you saw a relatively shorthanded Canadian national team really kind of take it to a relatively fully stocked men's team last year. If memory serves, the final score was somewhere in the neighborhood of like 24-18 or something like that. And it was really just because the precision passing that the Canadians displayed was the type of thing that the Americans couldn't really defend. And then certainly that was compounded by shooting on a 6-on-6 goal, which obviously for a player that grew up playing box lacrosse, that's easy. And so the ability to, the consideration of potentially shrinking the goal is also in play. I've heard about the idea of a 5-on-5 goal. I don't know what the viability of that is or what the likelihood of considering that is in a more serious way. But those are just kind of some of the considerations. John also asked about offensive efficiency. And it's in the article that I wrote, and you can, you know, if you Google highlights, observations, and reactions from World Lacrosse Olympic trial rules, and I'll tweet this out afterwards. the U.S. women's team shot 59.2%. The Canadians men's team shot 65.7%. That's obviously incredible efficiency. I think fans of field lacrosse would probably prefer a game where goals were being scored on somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 to 50% of possessions. And right now, this version of the game is considerably higher than that.
Terry, the next question, I believe it's coming out of your hometown. Is that correct?
It is.
From
yep.
Cleve?
Yep.
So let's talk about transition offense and the goalie making the first pass after a goal is scored. So first of all, explain what that, you know, ruling is in terms of this rule set, and what are the strategies that you think would be viable?
So this was a big point of feedback that the world lacrosse stakeholders got from the IOC and other multi-sport observers, particularly coming away, I think, from the women's game in Wrocław, Poland, which is that they really didn't like the pause in action to reset the ball for a face-off or a draw after a goal. And so, as a result, this rule set is written such that it's only the face-off or draw is only to start periods. It is not after each goal. So the goal is play is restarted by the goalie throwing the ball in. And I think this is going to be an area of the game that gets a lot of attention as games get played under this new rule set, for a variety of reasons. Number one, it's an important consideration for television. After a goal is scored is the primary time to replay the goal being scored, obviously. But if action restarts so quickly that the ball's already at the other end of the field before you've had an opportunity to replay the game, or replay the goal, excuse me, then you miss that opportunity. And then separately, the consideration of both substitution and the fatigue component of it, as well as the ability to try to get transition offense off of a made goal, or the equivalent of trying to get a fast break off of a made basket in basketball, I'm not certain that that's something that people want. I think people want transition off of defensive stops or turnovers, but not off of scored goals, with the exception of really, really special plays, such as, you know, a 75-yard outlet pass or something along those lines. So to my knowledge, I'm sure that this is the rule set. I haven't read it, so I'm going to plead ignorance on that particular question, but I will say that I expect it to be something that gets closer examination.
We got one from Connor Cirillo. You know, this is a question that I think has been asked a lot, but which countries are going to benefit from this? Which teams might be built better for this than other teams?
Yeah, so, I mean, in my opinion, there's no argument against, if you come from a box background, advantaged, because you're used to playing with fewer players on the field. Everybody's skill set's a little bit more similar, and also everybody is used to playing with a short stick. We probably should have mentioned earlier in this podcast, but in this rule set, everybody plays with a short stick. There are no long sticks in this game. And so in addition to everybody's familiarity with playing with a short stick, also that includes defenders defending with a short stick and transition players playing transition with a short stick. And so as a result, like, I expect this to wildly benefit Canada. It's basically, you know, box lacrosse, no boards, bigger goal, goalie wearing fewer pads. I mean, that's a recipe for a 75% or, you know, 65% shooting percentage for the Canadian offense. And I expect the Iroquois to benefit as well. And really, I think that more than anything else, this subjugates the advantages that the U.S. bring to the table. Because when you look at the U.S. advantages, the player pool is the biggest one. And so that depth that I talked about is likely always going to be the biggest advantage that the U.S. has, and that gets negated in this format. So when you get beyond the Canadian Iroquois consideration, then the nations that either play box lacrosse, like the Czech Republic, or the nations that have box lacrosse North Americans who qualify for their roster and are very, very good. We've seen this with the UK and or Great Britain and some others. Those are going to be the ones that benefit the most.
Question from Corey Balkin that I think has been, I don't know, the most contentious of questions, or the one that, you know, I've just heard this question a lot. And some people, I think, come at it from a frustrating angle of all of this stuff is making, you know, essentially the field game look more like box. Why not just box lacrosse? Why does this rule set exist? Why is it not just box lacrosse?
So the short answer to that question is because, harkening back to the point I made earlier, that this is a stakeholder driven process. This is outsiders trying to get in, not insiders trying to get outsiders to come in. The stakeholders, I think, just prefer a hybrid version of field lacrosse to box lacrosse. I'm pretty sure that the answer is that simple. To the extent that the answer is more complicated, one of the things that I have been told is that if lacrosse were trying to get into the winter games with box lacrosse, it would be a much easier path to entry. So I think it's a fair question, but I think that the answer is the people whose, I guess, kind of decision-making power it was to move it forward wanted to get a version of box, or I'm sorry, get a version of field lacrosse into the summer games and are totally comfortable with this version of the game being it.
Lastly, is this a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that totally depends on your perspective. There are a lot of people who would argue that getting lacrosse into the Olympics is not a worthwhile endeavor. And I think I can speak to that because I think at one point I was one of those people. I remember at some point kind of derisively making the comment, what's the value of being on Bravo on a Tuesday afternoon, the second weekend in August, once every 4 years? How does that advance the sport domestically in a way that is what we care about, right, as the majority of American lacrosse fans? And there is truth to that. This is a venture that will benefit not the United States more than the United States. I think that's indisputable. But if you really hold firm to that point of view, then I suggest the best way to potentially change your mind is to look into the transformative power that the opportunity to play on the Olympic stage has for athletes from around the world. And particularly with respect to the way that the sport will develop at a much more rapid rate if the sport is included in the Olympic Games, because of the way that that opens access to funding in pretty much every other country in the world, where sport funding is largely governmental, and that is almost exclusively determined by whether or not your sport is in the Olympics. So in terms of the sport, you know, lacrosse's potential to change, you know, a young German woman's life, or, you know, a young Ugandan boy's life, I think that the answer is pretty clearly yes. And it's not just about the Olympics. It's about the power of sport in total. But certainly, to the extent that this is a conversation that's about the Olympics, it is more so about that than it really is about anything else.
Well, this has been awesome. Terry, are you tired of talking about this yet? It's about 6 years you've been talking about this Olympic inclusion, I think.
Yeah, I'll never be tired of talking about it. It's really exciting for the sport, and certainly better than a lot of the possible alternatives, particularly in a moment when there isn't nearly as many lacrosse games being played as we would like.
Which I think is a good segue to kind of the what you might have missed portion of this podcast, and we'll kind of blow through these. But I'll start off with just the NCAA's reclassification of lacrosse's COVID-19 risk from high to intermediate. You know, this kind of report came out on the 13th, so that was about 5 days ago from recording, and I immediately got a bunch of text messages that was like, this is enormous for us. The reason being financial, in terms of if, you know, obviously it's a recommendation, not a ruling, but, you know, for these conferences that are, you know, thinking about their 2021 schedules and what their testing procedures might be, this guideline is a much less expensive and less costly, less demanding guideline than was previously put out there for the sport of lacrosse. You know, being intermediate versus being high means, you know, the testing goes down from, you know, basically every player multiple times a week to some players at various intervals during the season. So that's a huge cost-saving measure, you know, for conferences that might want to follow the NCAA's guidelines on COVID risk. And then as I'm looking forward to big story that's going to be coming down the road, you know, as Terry has to say goodbye here, and we're going to check in with him later, the story that's kind of coming down the pike that we haven't delved too much into yet, I want to talk about the Six Nations organization and their, you know, viability for the next year. You can see on IL Indoor that, you know, there's basically some talk that Six Nations won't be able to field its senior team. The Six Nations Chiefs might not be able to survive beyond the 2021 season. But I think this really brings up a broader point about lacrosse in Canada and you know, basically the viability of summer lacrosse and how that might change if NLL, you know, obviously this year NLL is going to shift into the summer. So that's going to be, you know, a pool of players both leagues are going to be playing for. And, you know, what does that mean for the future? If the NLL likes this shift and continues with the summer, then, you know, maybe that's going to be something that becomes a bigger issue down the road. So that's something that I'm following. We're going to continue bringing this podcast. You know, the idea is going to be Terry, myself, and a few others here at Inside the Cross talking about some of the biggest issues in the sport and also maybe giving a little peek behind the curtain of what we do at Inside the Cross, some of the decision-making that we have. So please, if you like it, follow us both on Twitter. I'm at Matt Kinnear, and Terry is at Terrence Foy. We're going to say goodbye for now, and we're going to talk to you next week. See you later.
Inside the Cross Podcasts, the source of the sport.